Ladies and gentlemen, we are back for another episode of We Might Talk Sports. I am your co-host, Matthew Carter, and before I continue, we have to introduce the host, the man, the myth, the legendary KJ. What's going on, man?
I don't know about all that, but I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. Hope everybody has been safe. Hope everybody is staying well, and I'm feeling good.
Summertime is here, and this is our first episode on the Blue Wire Hustle Network. So this is actually exciting, man. We haven't put out an episode in a while, but we did record an episode that we didn't put out back around March Madness time. But no, I'm glad to be back at it.
Yes, definitely shout out to Blue Wire Hustle. We appreciate all the support and all the behind the scenes stuff that they've been helping us with. For some of you that are first-time listeners and you've never heard us before, we talk about a variety of sports, NBA, NFL, college basketball, whatever's going on currently in the world of sports. We also talk about different music, so you hear us talk about albums, top 10, best of all time. You hear different things about music, and you also hear different cultural things. So expect a lot of entertainment, expect a lot of jokes. I give KJ a hard time, but in the end, he's my brother.
Yeah, you know, if it's not light, then what's the point? I mean, we're not exactly breaking down geopolitics and things like that. So, I mean, we are actually blood related, so that's part of the familiarity there. And you know, other than that, like, we just talking sports and like you said, music and other stuff. So we don't have to treat this like it's the most serious thing in the world.
Nah, there's a lot of other serious things going on right now. So this would be an opportunity for you guys to get some insight, to laugh and relax. And let's move on to the first thing, which is the NBA. And we do have to talk about the playoffs. And let's talk about the first round and what you think about going forward with the playoffs right now.
First round was crazy, man. I mean, we saw the two teams that played for the championship in the bubble last year both get beat. You know, the Lakers had their injuries and some other things, and they at least put up a bit of a fight. Miami just kind of laid down. You know, we saw some teams that, like the Knicks, where we thought that, you know, them getting there was a great story, but we really wondered if they were ready for prime time. We got the answer for that they weren't. But I think more importantly, what we've seen is a bit of an emergence of, like, the next generation of NBA stars. You know, the league has been so reliant on LeBron and Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, you know, guys like that for so long at this point. You know, LeBron's almost 20 years in the league, and Steph and KD are all 10 years plus. And then, you know, from there you mix in other players that fall in that ilk, all the 30 plus guys. But we've been waiting to see the emergence of a new crop of stars. And with how Trae Young performed in the first round, how Devin Booker just absolutely sniped the Lakers. You know, you see the emergence of Joel Embiid this year. Also, Denver with Jokic, even though, you know, he proven that he's an elite player before, but just this year really putting together an MVP campaign and helping to carry Denver into the second round without having Jamal Murray and just so many other guys. Like, I think that's one of the big takeaways that I've gotten from the first round of the playoffs, that we are seeing the next crop emerge, and I think that the league is in good shape for the next decade plus.
Got to give a big shout out to Trae Young. It's been a long time since I've seen a guy that's embraced the villain role in the NBA and that actually enjoys shit talking people. And Trae Young fit that to a T, whether it was in Atlanta or New York. But you're right, there was a lot of young stars that were good regular season players, but we didn't know how they would play in the postseason. You mentioned Devin Booker, Trae Young. Even though Ja Morant in Memphis lost, we saw Ja Morant, Donovan Mitchell.
Still showed up.
Yeah, he still showed up and still played his heart out. As long as he's healthy, Memphis is going to be there for a long time. So we got to see the emergence of a lot of young talent in the NBA, and I think it's good for the league for the points that you mentioned. Also, really outside of the Milwaukee-Miami series, all the other series were pretty entertaining. Even the ones that went five games or six games, they were entertaining. There was always stuff going on. I am convinced more than ever that I don't think there's anything better than NBA Twitter, because people are quick, they're witty, they're crazy. And the first round was wild, man. It was just, you wanted to really sit at home, or if you couldn't be at home and you had to be at work, you caught yourself during breaks, you caught yourself, well, I won't say what I did, but you caught yourself checking your phone phone just trying to see what the score was or what was going on Twitter or what was happening. So, the first round was great for the NBA. I still don't like those playing games for the 7th and 8th seed, but that's another conversation. But the first round was good.
We talked about that offline. We have different views on, how the play-in goes. But, I will say that even with that play-in, it did create a bit of intrigue this year because nobody expected Memphis to play their way in. If you wouldn't have gotten Golden State to lose to the Lakers, people at least expected Golden State to win that game. And that gave another opportunity for Ja Morant to emerge. And I think that what he did in the time in the playoffs, and if you include that play-in game also, it just shows that he is ready for prime time. Like you said, they're still a very young team, and they're not close to being able to compete and win a series like that. They won game one with Donovan Mitchell not playing. Like you said, I do think that that part should be reformed. But just in general, if I'm looking around the NBA as a fan, just aside from me being a Laker fan, but just a fan of the game, and if I'm Adam Silver, I'm saying we have some guys here. We have the next crop. And, we're going to get into Boston later, but one of their great young players, Jaylen Brown, has been injured, so he didn't play in the playoffs. But we know Jason Tatum is one of the best players in the league, too. And Boston's going through their own little turmoil right now, but, it wasn't that long ago that we saw those guys emerge. So, pretty much spread out throughout the league, there's a lot of teams that have hope that they can, build around blue chip, young, under 25 players. Now, how they do that, that's another story, because I do think that a lot of times teams waste these years of their emerging players, but at least on the surface, there's a starting point.
What do you make of the playoffs going forward? We got Utah versus the Clippers. We have Phoenix versus Denver. We got Philly versus Atlanta. And we have Brooklyn against Milwaukee. What do you make of these matchups?
Yeah, I think that the series that really has my attention in this next round is going to be, it's a couple, actually. I'm really intrigued by this Phoenix and Denver series, just because of the fact that Phoenix has the momentum of beating the defending champion. Devin Booker is playing at a level that a lot of us that have been pro Devin Booker knew that he could get to, but he hasn't really shown consistently. And, I've always thought he was a good playmaker, but, he's taken his playmaking to another level, especially with Chris Paul not being at 100%. And he's doing a little bit more on defense, too. And Denver is a team that, if they were at full strength with having Jamal Murray there, I thought that they could have made a good case for being a championship contender.
Yeah.
And, beating Portland's scrappy. We're going to get to them in a minute, but we still know Portland's incomplete. So now they're going to play against a real tough team that has championship aspirations. Even though Jamal Murray is a dynamic player, they still have a lot of other dynamic players aside from Jokic. We talked about this offline. Aaron Gordon coming to them has been amazing because he's done everything that they wanted him to do on the defensive end and given them a lot of versatility offensively also. So that series really has my attention. The Utah Clippers series has my attention too, but more so than that one, Milwaukee and Brooklyn. And even though right now, as we speak, Brooklyn has just blown out Milwaukee to go up 2-0, I want to see what that series looks like when it gets back to Milwaukee. They got Jrue Holiday for a reason, P.J. Tucker for a reason. As a team, they played much more efficient because of Jrue Holiday's presence this year. And this is really the show up or go home time for Budenholzer, because you put that much money into a team, they don't have much wiggle room to keep putting players around Giannis. You give him an all-star level point guard. They've put some other weapons around him. I know DiVincenzo's not playing, but seeing how he can try to make the adjustment against not at a full strength Brooklyn with James Harden not being in there, that really has my attention also. So I think those two series are the ones that I'm looking forward to the most throughout the second round. And, we'll project a little bit. I'm expecting a Brooklyn-Phoenix final with Brooklyn winning the championship. So we'll see what happens.
That's amazing considering our offline conversations and you were not feeling Brooklyn going to the championship, let alone winning. And now you have them winning. So this is interesting.
Hey, man, we got to adjust. I'm watching the games. Beforehand, when we talked about that, I was thinking more so on the line of healthy Embiid in Philadelphia and not quite knowing if Brooklyn was going to be able to have enough defense and rebounding and interior presence. I didn't realize realized Blake Griffin was going to turn back the clock. I haven't seen Blake with this much spring in like 4 or 5 years. Claxton, I always liked him. You know, he proved to be a good player for them this year. But, I mean, DeAndre Jordan's not even playing, and they don't miss him. You know, and he hasn't been the greatest over the last few years, but, like, they don't even miss the fact that a big body to be out there. And Kyrie and Durant are just out of this world, and we have to admit when we're wrong.
Look, it's not over yet. Anything can happen. We saw James Harden get hurt in game one, so we don't know how it's going to play out. I've always felt with the way Brooklyn put their team together, it was just a lot of offense. And I fell victim when Golden State was in their run of, oh, well, you know, they need this. When you got that much firepower, it's demoralizing when you're going against somebody because they could be up by 20 and that lead can be eviscerated in a couple minutes. And it's a lot of offense on Brooklyn, but it's still early, so we'll see where it goes with the Nets. I think the two series that I'm looking at the most, I'm very interested in Utah and the Clippers. The Clippers get a lot of shit online for a multitude of reasons, but right, I'm interested. Yourself. Of course you would say that. But I'm interested in seeing what happens with the Clippers because Utah was, a lot of people felt, the best team in the NBA all season. They had the best record, you know, and they pretty much were locked in at number one seed most of the season. And, you know, Donovan Mitchell didn't play game one of the first round, but after game one, they pretty much took out Memphis. So I'm curious to see how they do against a Kawhi Leonard, against, well, we don't know which Paul George it is. If it's playoff P or pandemic P. Somebody told me earlier that he gave pandemic P to Porzingis now. So
they can share it.
They can share it. That's a whole nother conversation. But I'm interested in seeing what happens with Utah because they shoot a lot of threes. They make a lot of threes. They give a lot of people hell on defense. And can they take that next step and get to a Western Conference Finals against a Clipper team that, truth be told, if they don't make it to the finals or win a championship, that team is going to look really different next year. So there was a lot riding on the Dallas series. There's a hell of a lot riding on this series against Utah. So just because they beat Dallas, everything's not well in the world. Like, if they lose to Utah or if they get blown out in a series against Utah, they got the same problems if they would have lost to Dallas. So I'm very interested in that series. And then on the East, I'm actually very interested in the Philly-Atlanta series because with a healthy Joel Embiid, Philly, honestly, I think they would have gave Brooklyn a lot of problems. But with Embiid having his injury issues, Ben Simmons is a different type of player. I know some people felt that Simmons and Embiid, maybe Philly would have had to move on from one of them, but I'm curious to see what happens with Ben Simmons is because with Embiid injured right now, there's a lot riding on Ben Simmons. I know they have Tobias Harris. I know they have Seth Curry. I know they have different guys on the team, but there is a hell of a lot riding on Ben Simmons. And can he step up to the moment and can he lead the team with a hurt Joel Embiid? Or is it going to fit into the narrative that this is Joel Embiid's team and they need Embiid to be healthy and Simmons is kind of the supporting cast? Atlanta's a good team. They're a young team, but they're a good team. They won game one, and if Philly's not careful, they will win game two and go back to Atlanta with a 2-0 lead. So I think there's a lot riding on that series. Again, Philly's the number one seed, and a lot of people didn't expect for them to be the number one seed. But if they have an early exit again and don't make it to the Eastern Conference Finals, there's some questions for that team in the offseason. So I'm really interested in those two.
Yeah, I mean, to what you said, it's part of the reason why, to me, the playoffs this year have been so interesting because we know that there's a lot of consequences for the teams that lose. You know, a lot of times you'll see a team that if they lose, they're like a year or two away anyway. There might not be wholesale changes, you know, if something happens. But, I mean, you can see number one seed in Philadelphia. They lose to Atlanta. They have to make a decision. Like, they're really going to have to make a decision at that point on Ben Simmons. We know it's not going to be Joel Embiid, but maybe even if it's we keep Simmons, but we have to, like, retool around them again. But that's still a major shift. You know, you talked about the Clippers. They're not out of the woods. You know, beating Dallas in 7 games with a Dallas team that, and we're going to talk about them in a little bit too, with the Dallas team that is Luka and some scrappy but unspectacular parts, the Clippers shouldn't have really gone 7 games with them. So they're not out of the woods either. And if they lose to Utah, especially if they lose in embarrassing fashion, we know that there's going to be a lot of changes there too. And, you know, you could say that also just for Utah. I wouldn't be surprised if Utah loses if there's a couple of big changes there too, because they're number one seed and people have been wondering, are they legit? So I think that when you look at what that is, you know, we talked about earlier Milwaukee, if they lose to Brooklyn, that could cost Budenholzer his job. I mean, this is a guy who's a former coach of the year. You know, there's a lot of things that are on the line this year, and teams that are not just going to be content with taking a small step in the process and getting ready for next year if they lose. Like, teams are going to be really aggressive about getting better.
Well, the NBA is wide open right now, and we're getting ready to talk about the Lakers in a couple minutes, but it's wide open to win a championship. And there are some organizations that are, you know, trying to build a young core and trying to develop. And then there are some, because the Warriors are down, you know, the Lakers have their issues, so they see a lane to get a championship. And these lanes don't open up often in the NBA, so when you get an opportunity, sometimes you have to go for broke. Brooklyn went for broke. They built their roster to win this season. They're not thinking about 3 years from now.
No, yeah, the NBA is as wide open now as it's been in a long time. Even when, before LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh formed the Big Three, teams like the Spurs that were looming, the Detroit Pistons that were looming, the Lakers, you know, that were looming. You know, they didn't necessarily always win the championship, but you knew that there was that group of teams that had proven that they could do it and that they were in position. And then obviously the Big Three changed the way that everything was done. There's really nothing looming right now where you can look down and you can say, okay, in 3 years, this team is going to be this, you know, because everybody's just in that stage of load up, build, see what we can do. The Boston situation, which we'll talk about in a minute, is a good example that things can change overnight now. So I think that there are teams that are trying to establish themselves as perennial contenders, but some of these teams that are at a point where they're looking like, or not contenders, but perennial playoff teams, are looking at themselves like, if we don't make the big jump this year, then we need to do something dramatically different going forward. So like you said, there's the sense of the league being wide open creates greater consequences for teams that don't win championships.
Moving on to the next thing in the NBA, I want to talk about the Lakers and Heat. They played in the NBA Finals last year. We know the Lakers won the championship. They beat the Miami Heat. Fast forward to this playoffs, both teams were eliminated in the first round. Lakers lost in 6 games. The Heat got swept. That's not something that's looked kindly upon in Lakerland. That's not something that Pat Riley enjoys very much. So what do you think is the next steps for both franchises?
Yeah, I think that with Miami, they're in a better position to make a bold move to improve, just because they have more tradable assets and more flexibility with some of those young players. You know, Tyler Hero didn't play as well this year as he did last year. Duncan Robinson, good shooter, but all the suspicions of him being pretty much a one-trick pony were proven to be correct. It's a hell of a trick, but he's not going to give you much aside from just being a good shooter. But Bam Adebayo is a really attractive player. If they wanted to move, they wanted to make a big move. Even Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero and Precious Achiuwa and some other things that they could put together, Kendrick Nunn, those things could still be attractive for them to make a pretty big upgrade also if they didn't include Bam. So I think for Miami, it's just figuring out where they think the season went wrong. There were some reports about Jimmy Butler having some issues with the coaching staff, and then also some issues with the younger players. There were some reports about some of the younger players, the work ethic falling off, you know, once they were out of the bubble environment and maybe taking what happened in the bubble for granted. You know,
yeah, I mean, when Jack Harlow makes a song about you, kind of hard not to take yourself seriously.
Clearly, right? So I think that there's going to be a bit of a mixture of refocusing, but we do know that, like you said, the way Pat Riley gets down, he's always foot on the gas. How can we get it going? And I think that they're gonna be strategic, but they're going to be aggressive in getting themselves back up there. And the flexibility that they have is going to be viewed as a strength. As far as the Lakers go, I do believe that if healthy, they could have won another championship this year. You know, it's hard to bet against healthy LeBron and healthy AD. I mean, you could look at LeBron. He was laboring on that ankle and really just became a jump shooter and a facilitator. That's not what you want him to do. I mean, he's an okay jump shooter. He's a great facilitator, but his game was just off. Too many turnovers, everything. Anthony Davis had 2 monster games, but just still didn't look right. So they're in a little bit of a tougher spot, though, because most of their money is tied up in those two, and then Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Caldwell-Pope does not have a lot of trade value to bring back another big-time player the way that some of those younger assets that Miami Miami does, and then Miami having a few big contracts to make the money match. So the Lakers are going to be in a spot where they're going to have to nibble around the edges a little bit. Dennis Schroeder, he's a polarizing figure.
That's one way of putting it, if you ask Kyrie.
Yeah, you know, he's a polarizing figure, but he is a player with some upside, and he's young. And a year ago, he almost shot 40% from three. This year, he shot closer to 35, but he still averaged 15 points and just under six assists and did a lot to keep the Lakers in the playoff hunt. So more than likely, you bring him back. Hopefully, the price is a little bit more realistic considering how he played in the playoffs. Andre Drummond, they got to make a decision on him. You and I talked offline about Marc Gasol yesterday, you know, Montrezl Harrell. Like, they have some pieces that are there. They just have to figure out what works. And more importantly, they have to get more shooting on that team. So I do think that both teams will make some sort of a comeback next year. But as we just said, with the NBA getting more and more competitive and teams looking to load up and really go for it because there's no real scary team out there. There's no super team out there. Nothing's a given with the Lakers or Miami going forward, even if they do upgrade their rosters.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of quick questions, and I'll start with Miami Heat first. First thing is, do you feel that a lot of what they did last year was because of the bubble or because of the players? Because I've been hearing a term online a lot now called, they've been referring to certain players, Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson, as bubble frauds. They play the way that they did because of the bubble and the environment, or it just didn't transfer over this season?
Yeah, I'm not a big believer in the whole bubble fraud stuff. I mean, I think that with Duncan Robinson, he can shoot. Like, we know that. And you can never discount the importance of shooting. With Tyler Hero, he's a young player, really talented. He's a bit of a late bloomer. You know, if anybody knows his story about how he ended up at Kentucky, you know, that was a late offer that he got. And, you know, he's just been ascending. There's been some questions about him maybe buying into the hype and, you know, living a lifestyle that is more conducive to somebody who's proven more. Whatever, it's the NBA. A lot of these guys do that. But I do think that there is something there. Like, you know, you don't get as far as they got last year and play with the level of consistency on both ends of the floor if you are a fraud. You know, now, can you tap into that again completely? Who knows? That's what they're hoping for, and that's what they're going to have to assess. But there is enough there to believe that those guys are both legitimate players. But I do think also that Miami lost a lot of their front court depth, you know, the four and the five positions, and they're going to have to address that too. So I think there's a lot of things. And Bam Adebayo had a good year this year, but he didn't necessarily take that next leap that we expected from him in the bubble either. Nobody's calling him a fraud. So there's a lot of improvement that has to happen with their younger guys. But at the same time, I think that if they were to come back as a similar version of what just got eliminated in the playoffs, but let's just say there was a couple of minor tweaks made to the roster, a little bit more shooting, a little bit more size, I actually think that they will be right back in the thick of things in the East next year. But Riley's going to make a thorough assessment. We'll say that.
And then the last question about the Heat. Victor Oladipo. They traded for Victor Oladipo. You like the trade. I like the trade. We felt that Victor would fit in very well with the Heat. They didn't have to give up a lot for him. He has an injury. He's out for the season. We know last year he had an injury that he ended up being out for the season. If you go back to 2019, he was looking like one of the best two-way players in the NBA. But now we got back-to-back seasons with injuries that in his entire season. Do they bring him back?
He's going to have to come back on a team-friendly deal. And I don't know if he's willing to do that. I mean, you're right. On paper, I wasn't sure what Victor Oladipo had left after the injuries, but they didn't give up a whole lot to get him. So that's what made the deal worth the risk. But as far as going forward, the money's going to have to be adjusted. You know, it might be one of those high per year salaries, a shorter term deal. So that way, you know, he can get paid, but they can still have the flexibility to trade him if need be or to get out of the contract in a quicker amount of time. But I don't see them giving him long term money if they give him the money at all.
I like Victor Oladipo. as a player. I think he's a fantastic player when healthy. That's the term I'm going to use for the Lakers in a couple seconds. But he's had a lot of injuries over the past couple years. And when you start having quads and tears and you're having to shut down for the entire season, you know, I don't know if he can hold up. When healthy, he's fantastic. You know, the if-when doesn't really work in sports. So if I'm Miami, unless, as you said, unless it's a team-friendly deal, I think that's just a player that he's going to have to move on from. They didn't lose a lot in bringing him in. So it's not just Victor. There are other questions with Goran Dragic and other players. But I don't think Victor comes back.
Yeah, no, look, and team-friendly goes both ways. I mean, team-friendly is shorter money and, you know, giving the team flexibility that way, where if there's guys that they want to pursue in free agency or via trade over the next year or two, they have the flexibility to do that. But also team friendly, which is why I mentioned, you know, if they give him a lot of money per year on a 1 or 2 year basis, it's important for these teams, as we know, a lot of times with making trades in the NBA, it's matching money. So if Oladipo comes back and he's still semi-productive, even if he's considered to be overpaid, that salary slot could be important in them moving some of those younger assets along with the Victor Oladipo to get a player who's on one of those supermax contracts or something close to it. So either way, it would be a thing where he's doing something for the team if he comes back. Longer contract, shorter money, or bigger money, shorter contract, but you got to do us this solid if you want to be back. And like you said, Pat Riley might just feel like, I don't even want to go down that road. You know, we took the gamble. It didn't work. Time to move on. So we'll see.
Now, switch it over to the Lakers. Few quick questions. Going to start off with the question everybody wants to talk about. Anthony fucking Davis. Man, what's the issue? What's the issue with his health? Is this his diet? Is this training? Is he enjoying the, in quotations, L.A. lifestyle too much? Like, he's in a lot of commercials now. What's up?
First of all, he's been in L.A. just like a lot of athletes long before he came to the Lakers. So the L.A. lifestyle would not be something that I would attribute to some of these other issues. I mean, like, he's always been a bit on the brittle side. We know that. The injuries have been serious for the most part. I mean, not obviously career threatening, but injuries that are going to take 15 to 20 games at a time, if not more. Kevin Garnett came out today and said that his training regimen, something ain't right. Charles Barkley said similar things. I mean, so those are old guard NBA guys. I've talked to a few people that are semi in the know of what could go on. I don't want to say too much, but let's just say that there's a lot of scrutiny with the way that not necessarily just Anthony Davis, but guys that sign big contracts, there becomes extra scrutiny that they didn't necessarily have before about how they spend their off seasons and how they train. We all know that they train. Like, the days of sitting on your ass all summer and not doing anything and then coming back in training camp to get in shape, like, that doesn't exist anymore. But the intensity of how you train, the methods of what you're using, all those different things are now under the microscope more than ever. And I think that for Anthony Davis, who knows what he'll adjust, but this is going to be a thing, because if the Lakers go into next year, especially with LeBron James getting older, he's still a great player. I still think that when healthy, like you said, we're going to have to say that with the Lakers, I still think that when healthy, he's the best player in the game. But we've seen now that the smaller injuries are starting to creep up on LeBron even more. So that means that you have young prime Anthony Davis there to pick up that slack. If he's missing more games than the guy who's about to be 37 is, then obviously there's something that's missing there. So, you know, it's really going to be on him to now take that leap. And part of taking that leap is just evaluating your process and evaluating, you know, your routine to be the best that you can be. And maybe he's already doing that and his body just isn't built for, you know, the rigors of a full 82-game season and the playoffs. Maybe there are things that he can improve. But either way, if the injury bug continues to hit him, his legacy is now going to be tarnished even more by that than winning that championship, because everything is bigger in L.A. when it comes to the Lakers.
I don't know about that last statement. But what I will say, if you remember last
year,
I have an extreme bias towards the Lakers. Anybody that knows me, and for those listening for the first time, I have to inform you, I am a Laker hater. I've been that way since I've been 6 years old. KJ can attest to this. That will never stop. So I'm a little biased with my Laker commentary. But the reason I start off with Anthony Davis, and obviously anybody that's, you know, been keeping up with basketball this past season knows that that's kind of been the talk, is when Anthony Davis is healthy, he's one of the best players in the NBA, top five, top three, and he's unstoppable. But the problem is, and he had these issues in New Orleans too, he's consistently hurt. It's a shoulder, it's a foot, it's an ankle, it's a wrist, it's an elbow. Something is always messed up. It's his lower back. And he has all these different nagging injuries that keep him out. And the way that the Lakers are built, they can't afford for Anthony Davis to be out for long stretches of time. We get that, you know, players will rest. Players may miss a game or three or four with some nagging injuries. But for a guy of Anthony Davis's level to be in the league as long as he has to every season, you have more of an injury report than Chris Paul, who has constant nagging injuries. Something is wrong. And for the Lakers, last year when they won the championship in the bubble, I saw some people referring to Anthony Davis as a Laker great. And you don't become a Laker great after one season. You have to do it multiple seasons, winning championships at an extremely high level. Or if you don't win multiple championships like some of the Lakers did in the 60s, still they were great players deep in the playoffs in the NBA Finals for multiple seasons. And I said this to you jokingly in our text thread. He got a lot of slack online about being hurt. We saw what Snoop Dogg posted on Instagram. But if Anthony Davis has another season like this, Laker Nation will turn on him quickly.
Oh, without a doubt, because it's already happening. I mean, you're already starting to see what it is. And I think that for a lot of Laker fans, they were aware of who he was. You know, because look, we know, just like with any fan base, you got some fans that, like how you are with the Bulls, you love the Bulls, you watch the Bulls, but you are a lover of basketball, so you watch the whole league. And you got, and that's how the Lakers are, but then you have some fans that just watch the Lakers, and they know of the other players, you know, in a more vague sense. Now that they've seen Anthony Davis up close, there's a couple of things that if you follow Lakers Twitter, that have annoyed them. Number one, they don't like the fact that he doesn't like to spend more time in the post. And that's kind of a generational thing, with people not necessarily loving the way modern basketball is played without a lot of back-to-back scorers. But that's been the thing, settling for too many jump shots. And then also just the injury bug. Because with the Lakers so far in both seasons, like you said, there has been stuff. You know, the championship in the first year made it all worth it. Because I definitely think that if you win a championship, regardless of what was given up to get you and whatever they had to do, that's what you play those games for. So it makes it worth it. But there is still a sense with him that, me being a Laker fan as long as I've been my whole life, and understanding how this fan base works, if you're not homegrown, they can turn on you. You know, they will get quickly, and they will get tired of you. You know, if Anthony Davis was drafted by the Lakers, number one overall, when he came out, they would make all the excuses in the world about the injuries. But considering the price that they gave up to get him, some popular young Laker players that were homegrown, they will get tired of this. And there's already a bit of an uneven relationship with LeBron James. So, and Davis is viewed as an extension of that whole thing too. So for his sake, because he seems like a nice enough guy, great player, and me just being a Laker fan, I hope that, you know, he can get over this part of his career, dealing with a lot of these injuries and find more consistency with his health. But, you know, this is a real crossroads for him, because if the Lakers struggle next year and it's another first or second round exit and he misses 20 plus games, including playoff time, it's going to be really hard for him to get back his reputation in this city.
And one final question about the Lakers, and we'll move on to the next thing in the NBA. And I know you mentioned Schroeder earlier when you were talking about what the Lakers should do in the offseason. Do you still think that they need another point guard? Because I've heard Kyle Lowry's name come up in trade talks. I've heard, you know, the Lakers need to get a different type of point guard than Schroeder. Do you think the Lakers need a point guard?
I think that they need a better, and we talked about this yesterday offline, I think that they need a better backup point guard. Like, I think Schroeder as your starter, it doesn't necessarily work for every team, but I think it works for this team. You need a secondary playmaker with LeBron on the court, but then you need somebody who could be the primary guy when LeBron is off the court. And Schroeder being young, athletic, and a good shooter helps. But there are still certain things about the game that he doesn't get offensively and defensively. He gets lost on defense a lot, you know, whether he's playing somebody straight up, not being able to fight through screens, switches. Like, it's a lot of stuff on defense that just makes you want to scream at the TV. But offensively, he doesn't quite have a feel for the game on when to get his teammates involved, where to get them in the right spots. A lot of times, and it's hard coming off of watching Rondo for 2 years, because we know Rondo is the master at that. And I think that if you have a more traditional point guard, even if they're only playing 10, 15 minutes off the bench, it would help Schroeder a lot more. Caruso's not that guy. Caruso's a good defensive player, but he's a rotational guard. Like, you know, he shouldn't be getting more than 10 to 15 minutes a game. So I think for them, they need to upgrade there. But Schroeder's upside is too good to pass up on if you're the Lakers, when you know that because of your cap situation, you don't have a lot of better options.
I tend to disagree. I'm not the biggest fan of Dennis Schroeder being a starter. I think he's a backup, but he's not a bad option to have. I just don't think he's a starter, but there's a lot of teams in the NBA that would like a Dennis Schroeder, rather he's a starter or a backup on their roster.
But let me ask you, though. You say that you disagree, you think he's a backup, not a starter, but considering the Lakers' financial situation, who can they upgrade with?
Well, that's the thing, because looking at the Lakers' financial situation and the money that's tied up into LeBron and to AD, even Kuzma when he signed his extension. So they don't have a lot of cap flexibility. So you look at a guy like Dennis Schroeder and his ability, I don't think they should throw Schroeder away, but they have to have another point guard option, is because Dennis Schroeder, in my opinion, has too many inconsistent lulls. I don't hate Schroeder. I think Schroeder is a good point guard. I think if you have him as your point guard, you're doing better than a lot of teams in the NBA. If you look at the Lakers roster, I just think that they need another point guard. I know you mentioned a different style of point guard. Rondo was there last year. Schroeder wasn't. I just think they need a different style of point guard. When he was in OKC, he had his inconsistencies, but they had Chris Paul, they had Shai Alexander, so there was cover there. The issue that he had when he was in Atlanta was, when he was a backup point guard, he was fine, but when he became the starter in Atlanta, those inconsistencies crept in. And I think for the Lakers, and the Lakers are going to depend a lot on him as a starting point guard. Like, he can't have playoff series where he has 0 points or 6 points, or, you know, Magic Johnson criticizing him after they lose game six. Schroeder takes that shit seriously.
And there's a bigger target on his back because of the fact that he turned down, I think it was $84-85 million, and feeling like he can get more on the open market. And look, to his defense, not that he needs my defending him, when he turned down that money, he's playing very well, and he could have made a reasonable bet on himself that he would have been able to get 20 to 25 a year on the market, considering that there's going to be a thin point guard market in free agency. Then you have the whole COVID protocol stuff, and then him not playing well in the playoffs, and now all of a sudden things change. I agree with you. Ideally, he would be a really good six-man first guard off the bench. He's got starter potential, and that's what's going to continue to get him there. And he proved to be a better player in OKC than he was in Atlanta. A lot of that was him growing up. He's admitted that. You know, too much too soon for him. But the main issue here with the Lakers is with anything. We talked about trade slots with Miami, having the money to do certain things. It's very similar with Schroeder, but more than anything, they just don't have the flexibility. You know, if he walks because they say that he's too expensive and they can't find a way to get Kyle Lowry this time, you know, that was something that was brought up at the trade deadline, but I don't know if the logistics of that trade work now that Lowry's a free agent. So when you're talking about doing a sign and trade, like, you're bringing in all kinds of different factors now. You know, I'm more concerned about, are they going to overpay to keep Alex Caruso? Like, I'm more concerned about that stuff, because there are some things, some areas where they can upgrade their shooting, upgrade their capability as far as rebounding, You know, is Kuzma going to take the next step? Because he really didn't play well in the playoffs either. Like, I'm more concerned about that stuff because I think with Schroeder, at worst, you know that he's going to be solid. But there's other guys that were outright awful.
I thought you liked Alex Caruso. You just sending me YouTube clips of him and him dunking on Kevin Durant. And
I told you that this is what the Laker fans believe. There is a cult of Caruso. I never gave
No, I know that's what Bleacher Report believes. You see more stuff about Caruso than LeBron.
Trust me. As a Laker fan, I spend a lot of time on Lakers Twitter, and the love for Alex Caruso is real.
It's weird.
Let me tell you how real this is. If the Lakers let him go, and let's just say, you know, decided to get somebody who's better, there would be fans that would say, well, how come they gave up on Caruso? Like, Laker fans would actually rather see Schroeder go than Caruso.
They bugging. Moving on to our next topic in the NBA, and we want to talk about the Dallas Mavericks and particularly Porzingis. They lost yesterday in a Game 7 against the Clippers. Very contested 7-game series in the first round. We know how good Luka is. He just reminded the world that he is going to be a superstar in the NBA. He's probably going to be a top 5. Some people say he already is now. A top 3 player in the NBA, probably by the end of next year. And he had an incredible series, but they did lose to the Clippers in 7 games. Porzingis decides today that reports have come out that he often feels as an afterthought to Luka. Not the thing you would expect to hear from, you know, one of your important players after a very competitive 7-game series. We've also have discovered that the Mavericks have been secretly trying to trade Porzingis for the past year, but haven't been able to find any suitors. What do you make of Porzingis' comments? Are they justified? Does he need to pick his play up? We know he's had a long injury history since his time with the Knicks. It's just he had a lot of highs with the Knicks, but he's never played 82 games. To be honest, he's never played 75 games. The most he's ever played in the season was his rookie year, 72 games. He's missed a lot of games. He had an ACL injury in 2018. He clearly hasn't been the same player since then. What do you make of Porzingis' timing, and why do this now?
He's always been a guy who doesn't mind speaking up, even if he needs to shut up. And this is a situation where he is showing a complete lack of self-awareness on what the situation is. He is teammates with one of the most dynamic players that the NBA has seen in recent memory. And Luka's game is far from perfect, but it does not take much. If you know the basketball, it does not take much to realize that he's special. Ideally, he would be Luka's co-star. That's the way that this team is designed, but he hasn't played up to it. He's lost on defense. He doesn't rebound anymore. He's allergic to trying to post up. Maybe that's because he's light in the ass, but still, he doesn't do it. He's not a willing passer. And his game is just basically as a face-up guy that will occasionally attack the basket and a guy that will sit outside and shoot threes. That's it. He's getting paid to be a franchise guy. And while Luka's on his rookie contract, this is the perfect time for them to be able to build around him in a way that gives him a little bit more flexibility. Porzingis' deal is killing all of this. So for him, like, I get it. He's still young himself. He came into the NBA with a lot of promise. You know, we were calling him the unicorn a couple years ago. I get that. Like, that was not long ago, and he probably still views himself in that way. But he doesn't play like that. I mean, you can make a case that in this series against the Clippers that he might have been their fourth best player.
Yeah.
Maybe fifth. So, like, if I'm Dallas, I don't care. I don't care about his opinion. I'm going to still continue to try to move him if somebody wants to take him. But he needs to play a lot better for me to start caring about anything he has to say.
You know, people don't realize this. In 2018, they actually traded for him and Hardaway before they drafted Luka. And the idea Cuban had was to pair Porzingis and Luka together. That was the original vision. Because the trade draft day was Luka for Trae Young. But the original vision Cuban had was Porzingis and Luka. And he figured the two of them, when Porzingis got healthy the following season, and to have him with Luka, Once they got used to playing with each other, he'd have a dynamic duo that would be tough to stop. Well, Luka has developed, I think, even better than people had thought, and Porzingis has not become that guy. He's even the following season in 2019, when he got on the court, he's been timid this entire time. He's had continuous injuries. Even this season, he's been injured off and on, and people got excited when he was getting healthy. And Porzingis just hasn't been the guy that we saw in New York. He's been timid. He's afraid to post up. He shoots ill-timed shots. He doesn't pass the ball. He doesn't really flow in the offense. He kind of gets lost. So it leaves Rick Carlisle at a weird position, because you see Hardaway balling. You see Brunson balling. Powell, in the minutes that he gets, he balls. Like, everybody else on the Mavericks plays hard, but Porzingis is just kind of out there floating. But you're paying him a shitload of money, so you got to have him out there. And he is 7 foot plus, so you're figuring, like, all right, if I can get some of the unicorn. But we haven't seen the unicorn. He's been missing in action for years.
Dorian Finney-Smith was a better option for them in this series than Kristaps Porzingis.
I'll put it to you like this. If they could have gotten 40%, 50% of Porzingis, they beat the Clippers easily.
Yeah.
They didn't even get that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, no, he doesn't have enough of a leg to stand on here to be upset about anything that's happening in Dallas right now, because he's not living up to his end of it.
Not at all. Not at all. Staying in the NBA, moving to another team, Portland Trail Blazers. They fired Terry Stotts after 8 seasons. Damian Lillard has, you know, and this wasn't cryptic, he posted a message on Instagram, you know, kind of venting out his frustrations. He mentioned Jason Kidd by name, saying that he's the guy that he wanted. Jason Kidd kind of, you know, backed away from that. Personally, I think Jason Kidd is eyeing that Laker job, and if Fogle has another bad season, Kidd will take over. But that's a whole nother conversation.
A quick side note, Vogel is actually entering year 3 of a 3-year contract, and the Lakers said that they will discuss contract extension negotiations, but they're not, like, it's not imminent. They have other things that are more pressing, so you might be on to something.
That situation was always weird. You called it when it happened. Just the ghost of Jason Kidd has always been there, and I think he's still eyeing that job. So if Frank Vogel has another herky-jerky season, I don't think he makes it to the playoffs this time next year. So just keep an eye on that. But Portland, you know, they made some moves during the season. They brought in Powell. You know, they brought in Jokic a couple years ago. And they've tried to tinker with the roster here and there. But really, they went to one Western Conference Finals. But outside of that, they've had 4 or 5, I can't remember, first-round exits in the 8 years with Terry Stotts. They've made the playoffs, but they've been eliminated in the first round. So what do you think Portland should do? Should they continue with Dame and CJ and try to, you know, add complementary pieces? Should they tear it down and rebuild? What do you think Portland should do?
Unpopular opinion. I actually think that it's time for them to completely tear it down.
Wow. You got to unpack that.
I mean, look, Dame is offensively one of the top 3 players in the NBA. But, you know, we know that his game, he's not a two-way guy. CJ McCollum is a really nice player, but he should probably be the 3rd best player on the championship team, not the 2nd best player. And Norman Powell was a nice addition, but that still wasn't going to get them over the hump. I mean, like, if we assume everybody's healthy and Denver is healthy, the Lakers are healthy, Portland's still probably like the 6th best team in the West.
Yeah.
Maybe 7. So there's not a clear path for them forward. CJ's in his late 20s. Dame is in his early 30s. I believe he turns 31 over the summer. Still a great player. But this is where he's at peak value to get something for him. They've never been an attractive free agent destination. And even if they break Dame and CJ up, like a lot of people have been saying they should have done over the last couple of years, at this point, what is CJ McCollum going to bring you back that puts you in a better position than where you are now? I think that, you know, with teams looking to be as aggressive as they can be to improve themselves, you have teams that have some flexibility that will be able to give you a lot in return for Dame. And I don't want to get into a lot of fake trade scenarios, but I mean, I've read them, I've seen them. A lot of them are plausible. Money works and you're getting back good players in return. CJ McCollum will get you a nice return back also. And I think that that's probably the way to go. You know, they need to be a team that starts building assets. You know, similar to how Oklahoma City now has 17 first round picks.
Nah, they got like 76 first round draft picks.
76, a gazillion, whatever it is, right? Like they have a war chest of first round picks and a lot of second round picks also over the next 5 or 6 years. And that's because they were able to diagnose, like, you know what? We're a good team, but we're not a championship team. Russ, Paul George, you know, that group wasn't going to get them anything. And they were able to recognize Steven Adams. They were able to recognize it early and they moved on. And I think that this is the case where Portland should probably be too soon rather than being too late. And if they trade Dame, the fans might be upset. But, you know, Portland Trailblazer basketball is an institution up there. So the fans will be there if they know that it's communicated to them that there's a plan in place. Dame doesn't have to be the bad guy in this scenario. But this is just going to be a thing where they're going to nibble around the edges. They're going to tinker with some other parts. You know, and still not be a true contender. And I don't think that that's good for anybody.
Dame is one of my favorite players in the league. He has a cold-blooded mentality. He will go at anybody. This Portland team reminds me of the Memphis Grizzlies team, the grit and grind era with Gasol and Randolph and Tony Allen and Mike Conley. And it was a good group, played a lot of basketball, won a lot of games, playoff victories, playoff heartbreaks, never got to an NBA championship, only made the Western Conference Finals a couple times, and it was all in all a good era of Memphis basketball, but they held on to that group too long, and that group got old. You see the young group now with Ja Morant and Jackson, Dylan Brooks, and honestly, that project should have started about 2 years before it actually did. With this Portland team, they've been together for a long period of time. There's been some fun stuff with Dame and Paul George, Dame hitting game winners. Dame arguably had one of the craziest closeout shots and then poses after making the shot I've ever seen in a playoff series. But this group isn't going to win a championship. If you want to be really honest, this group isn't going to go to the Western Conference Finals again. They shouldn't have went the year they actually went. So if you just want a team that's going to keep making the playoffs but not doing anything, you're wasting your time. And in sports, you need to either be really, really good or really, really bad. And if you're going to be bad, at least have a project or an idea of rebuilding the team. I like Dame. I like CJ. But this isn't going to produce any championships. It's just going to be a lot of moral victories.
What you just said is perfect. Like, you know, and I agree because I was going to say it too. There's no value in being in the middle.
No. Nope.
So be really good and compete, or be really bad, bottom out, and start over. And Neil O'Shea is not a bad general manager. This is not NBA 2K, but if you look at what they have on their roster, they have guys that aside from Dame and CJ, you know, Dame is an elite player, CJ is a good player. They have other guys on this roster, though, that can provide a lot of value to good teams if they really decide to tear it down. And with Neil O'Shea being a solid GM, this wouldn't be the type of turnaround that's going to take 20 years. Robert Covington has a lot of value yes. to a team that's looking to do something, a good playoff team. Nurkic has value to a good playoff team. You know, Norman Powell is going to be a free agent, but they have a lot of parts that with better teams can do something, and teams would actually give up something of value to get them, because these are guys that you put them in rotations elsewhere and teams will find that, yeah, giving up first round draft picks or young players is worth it. But as a whole and as a collective for what they are in Portland, that ship has sailed. So look, I get it. You still want to be able to get people to come to the stand, you know, to the arenas. You know, Dame is crossed over from not just being a great player for them. He's become a cultural icon because he's embraced the city and the organization in a way that is unique to superstar players in today's NBA. You know, been very out front about not wanting to be the guy that chases super teams and all the rest of it. And that's why if you take this decision out of his hands, he can still be that guy for the franchise somewhere else. Like, you can still retire his jersey. You can still do all those other things. You know, don't put him in the position to have to make that tough decision. You know, they need to do that themselves, because at this point, the value is never going to be higher than what it is now. So it's like, take advantage of that.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Oklahoma City Thunder, and they did the same thing with Russell Westbrook. When they realized that, you know, that we weren't going to win anything with this, Paul George left in the middle of the night. Russ knew that it was going to be a rebuilding project. So rather than to put Russ through that, they sent Russ to Houston. Obviously, that didn't work out. But they took the decision out of his hands. Westbrook wasn't one of those guys that was trying to jump from team to team to win a championship. So in this situation with Portland and Dame, I don't want to see Dame as a guy that's 36, 37 years old. You know, his first step is gone. He still has his shot, but he's not the same guy anymore. And he's trying to thug it out with the Blazers. And it's like they are even further away from sniffing a championship. And there's this guy that had this incredible career that never got close to even going to an NBA Finals and playing at the highest stage. And great player, but just stuck on the Blazers.
No, I agree. I agree. You know, it's got to be, they have to be willing to make tough decisions. But something tells me they're not going to do it, and they're going to just put more Band-Aids around something, and it's just not going to end well for anybody.
No, no. And then our last thing in the NBA, we do have to talk about the Celtics. And a lot happened in a very short amount of time. Boston lost to Brooklyn in the first round. A couple of days later, we find out that Danny Ainge is retiring. We also find out that Brad Stevens is moving from the head coach to the front office. All this happened in a three-day span. So, couple questions. First question, obvious question. Does any of this make any sense? What is the next move for Boston? Because literally, it went from got eliminated by Brooklyn, Ainge is retiring, Stevens is moving to the front office. This all happened in a three-day span. So what's next?
Yeah, I think for them, obviously finding a head coach is the first thing on the priority list. Brad Stevens is a top five, top 10 coach in the NBA. So you have to be able to replace him. All reports are is that they're looking for an ex-player. And, you know, the names that I've heard have been Darvin Ham and Ime Udoka, who's the assistant with Brooklyn, played with the Spurs. You know, that's the main thing there. And they still have to develop. Like, they're not in a spot where you need to just find a coach who's there for the X's and O's. There's going to be a lot of player development that's still going to be of the utmost importance, because we forget that both Tatum and Brown are under the age of 24. So they have to continue to evolve. They have some young pieces that have emerged as intriguing players, Robert Williams, Romeo Langford, Peyton Pritchard, you know, guys like that. So they're going to continue to, they're going to have to find somebody that knows how to develop, but at the same time is going to be good with the X's and O's, because there is an expectation that this team needs to be top five in the East and, you know, contend. As far as how we got here, there have been rumblings, according to things that I've read over the last 2 to 3 months, that Danny Ainge might be considering this. Some people think that it's a retirement full time. He's had some health issues, think he had a heart attack a couple years ago. And then others feel like he just needs to take a year or two off, and then he might try to resurface somewhere else. Brad Stevens has talked about how this last year and a half or season and a half, including the bubble time, has been really tough on him mentally and, you know, just with his family and some other stuff, and he was feeling a little burnt out. Front office isn't necessarily a place for somebody that's burnt out, but, you know, whatever. I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of expectations that come along with being a Celtic, whether you're the coach, GM, or a player. I think there's even more expectation that comes about being with this organization currently when you have two elite young players that have proven to be brilliant at times, but frustrating at times also. So like this is the part of the progression where if they weren't going through such a massive change, we'd be looking to see Tatum and Brown take the next step in their games. So there's a lot of things that are up in the air right now with the Celtics and a lot of pressure on Stevens to be just as efficient as Ainge, if nothing else. I mean, we can get into Ainge's legacy if you like, but to at least be, you know, competent in the job. But really who he hires as his replacement on the bench, I think is going to speak volumes about what the Celtics' future is going to be.
Okay, let me ask you about Ainge's legacy. I mean, Danny Ainge has been the GM for quite a long time. He's the guy that brought in Doc Rivers. Doc Rivers had a long tenure, got an NBA championship out of that. Ainge is also the guy that traded for Kevin Garnett, and a lot of people feel that Garnett changed the culture of the Boston Celtics, and they went from, you know, a team that was trying to rebuild and trying to restore legacy to, you know, restoring the legacy. So what do you make of Ainge's legacy with the Celtics? I know we could be here for a long time, but what do you make of it?
Well, I think, you know, Ainge has a very complicated legacy, to say the least.
Yes.
But he took over a franchise that was a complete dumpster fire, and he made them one of the perennial playoff teams slash contenders over the last 10 plus years, actually closer to 15 at this point. And he did it with the big three, then he did it with young guys, he did it with the scrappy group of cast-offs that Isaiah Thomas led. I think for Ainge, the big thing that's going to always, I think, complicate his legacy, and Celtic fans, you've seen them discuss this, is his unwillingness to necessarily make the big move. And, you know, he hoarded a lot of assets once he made the Kevin Garnett, Ray, Paul Pierce trade to Brooklyn. And it was like he was just in asset collecting mode, and it was always supposed to lead to this big thing. Eventually, they were able to get Kyrie. That looked great on paper. He played well when he first got there, and then we know things turned sour. He signed Gordon Hayward, and he still had, you know, something left for him to do something else. And obviously, it felt like the last big piece was hoping he can get Anthony Davis to pair in, and then that never happened. So I think that Ainge's legacy is going to be a lot of what-ifs, missed opportunities for some. But at the bare minimum, we do have to acknowledge that it is not easy to run an NBA franchise at a competent level for as long as he did. And he made them a very steady franchise, if not always spectacular, at least steady. And I think for that alone, he's leaving Brad Stevens in a much better position than what he inherited himself.
But, I mean, for those that said that he was hoarding draft picks, and he did, I'm not here to say that he didn't, but out of those picks, he got Jason Tatum, he got Jaylen Brown, and he got Marcus Smart. Now, yes, there were a lot of other picks that didn't quite turn out well, but to get those three guys, that's not a bad haul.
For all the criticism that he can get for hoarding the picks, we have to give him credit for doing something that not a lot of other people would have done, and that he got ridiculed for at the time, which was he had the number one pick, which people assume was going to be Markelle Fultz.
Right, and he traded it.
Traded it to Philly. So he trades down to three to draft Jason Tatum. And even with that, some people didn't think that that was the right pick. I mean, people thought Josh Jackson was going to be a better pick, De'Aaron Fox. Like, there were a lot of people that thought that there were other picks to be made at that spot. So he was able to see something. Even when he drafted Jaylen Brown, people thought he was doing that on potential, and they felt like that was a risky pick. So, look, he hit big when it mattered in a lot of situations. But there were some times where some of these other picks, like the lack of depth that they have on that roster right now, is just the talent drain. You know, him not being interested in getting Miles Turner for Gordon Hayward, him letting Al Horford walk out the door, and then some of these young guys that he's drafted and that he's picked up through free agency and, you know, just undervalued guys that he liked that haven't panned out. So the lack of depth is on him too. But overall, I think it's hard to dispute that he was a really good GM.
And before we close out on the NBA and the Celtics, quick story about Danny Ainge. This was actually the 2017 NBA draft, and there was a lot of talk that were the Celtics going to take either Jason Tatum or Josh Jackson. And Danny Ainge, Brad Stevens, and the assistant general manager at the time, Mark Zarin, they actually flew cross-country to Sacramento for a workout with Josh Jackson, and when they got there, they found out that the workout had been canceled. And Danny Ainge never spoke to Josh Jackson about the canceled workout. Josh Jackson swore it was a miscommunication. Ainge just took it as he didn't want to be a Celtic. They took it as Tatum is our guy. We know how Josh Jackson's career has turned out, so there you have it.
It worked out. Blessing in disguise.
Yeah. It's amazing how those things happen. Moving from the NBA to the NFL, got to talk about Julio Jones. The saga finally ends. Julio Jones goes to the Tennessee Titans. We know about Julio wanting to leave Atlanta, the weird thing that happened with Shannon Sharp, and he's finally gone. He's on the Tennessee Titans. Does this make the Titans a legit Super Bowl contender now, or are they just a better team in the AFC?
Better team in the AFC. Ryan Tannehill is an improving quarterback, but I still don't know if I trust him as a Super Bowl level quarterback. Defensively, they're really solid. Derrick Henry has been the engine of that offense. You know, if you look at what the Tennessee Titans have right now from an offensive standpoint with Julio Jones and AJ Brown, that's a really good receiver duo. Now, Brown is an emerging young guy. Jones is a future Hall of Famer, arguably the best receiver over the last decade in the NFL, but not quite a pure number one anymore. Probably better as a 1B or a really good number two. So really, this is just a matter of how well A.J. Brown continues to develop. But look, if I'm Tennessee, I get it. Go all in. We talked about the NBA being wide open. The NFL is wide open, too. So you have to make the move. It wasn't super expensive for them, but I don't think that this move means for them what it would have meant if he would have gone to, like, San Francisco or the Rams or even a place like Baltimore. But it still definitely puts the Titans firmly in the middle of that playoff hunt.
We'll never know all the teams. I mean, we heard rumors about New England and Seattle and San Francisco and Baltimore and other teams that were interested, but we'll never really know if Julio would have ended up on those teams because, as I said, the weird thing with Shannon Sharp and it killed all the leverage. So he ends up on the Titans, but let's be honest, that offense is Derrick Henry. It's not Ryan Tannehill. A.J. Brown, as you mentioned, is an up-and-coming receiver. It gives them explosion on offense, but if they're depending on Ryan Tannehill to lead the offense, they're not going to go anywhere. That's a team that is built defensively, and for the offense, Derrick Henry to beat up on the other team all four quarters, and Ryan Tannehill not to make turnovers. Adding Julio Jones helps. I think this definitely shifts power balance back to Tennessee's favor in that division as far as them and Indianapolis and Jacksonville, but I don't think this makes them better than Kansas City.
No, I don't think this makes them better than Kansas City. I still like Buffalo better. They were always pretty even with Baltimore for me, but yeah, I still think Kansas City is a team to beat in the AFC with Tennessee probably being, if you're going to do an AFC power ranking, they're probably like fourth or fifth.
Well, what's funny is Tennessee actually lost their offensive coordinator, Arthur Smith, to the Falcons to become the Falcons head coach. And now he sends Julio Jones to Tennessee. But they also, in all seriousness, they also lost a lot of people in free agency. They lost Janu Smith, the tight end. They lost Corey Davis. They lost Adam Humphrey. So Julio Jones will help. But as I said, it doesn't make them better than the Chiefs. I mean, you can make arguments. Does this make them better than Cleveland? Does this make them better than Baltimore? I don't know. It depends on who you ask. But I think this makes them a better team than the AFC. But I've been seeing a lot of stuff as all Super Bowl contenders and Kansas City better watch out. And I don't think we're there yet.
No. I do like them better than Cleveland. We've seen too many teams that emerge for 1 year in the NFL and then they revert back to something else. I'm still a little skeptical on Cleveland. Tennessee has been a good team for the last couple of years. So this, even with the losses that they had, they are a well-coached team that plays within themselves, meaning they play with Derrick Henry first, second, third. You know, he is the engine of that offense. And they play a lot of ball control. Julio Jones is going to be perfect for a ball control type offense because he can move the chains. He can still stretch the field a bit. But, you know, this is a guy who's going to be able to play within that system and still give them the capabilities that they need in the passing game to open things up even more for Derrick Henry. So, look, it's not a bad move. And like I said, it wasn't like an exorbitant price. I do think that the impact would have been better on other teams. But if you're Tennessee and you're trying to get a foothold in the AFC that seems to be pretty wide open, you do what you can. And if a future Hall of Famer is available for a couple of draft picks, you got to take it.
Yeah, you got to take it, as we talked about in basketball. The window is short to win a championship. So if you have an opportunity to improve your roster and to get closer and closer to those steps, you take those opportunities. They don't come very often. And with an AFC that has Kansas City, that has Buffalo, that has, you know, other teams in the conference, you want to be one of the best teams. And you never know with an injury, you never know if somebody has a bad game, and you could wind up in a Super Bowl, you could wind up winning the Super Bowl. So you want to take those opportunities when you can. Good move by Tennessee. You know, Atlanta didn't get the haul that I think they thought that they probably could get for Julio Jones, but that distraction is gone. I think both teams will move on and be happy.
Yeah, that's what this is. It was just time for them to go their separate ways, and you get what you can get. Like you said, the whole Shannon Sharpe situation, we'll never know what it did for leverage or what it didn't do, but it couldn't have helped. So, you know, you move on shortly before training camp, and Atlanta can get on with their rebuild. I know they don't want to call it that because Matt Ryan is still there, but this is a rebuild, and Tennessee can put themselves in position to make a Super Bowl run.
Switching to college basketball, there's been some big-name college basketball coaches that have retired. We know about Roy Williams. We know about Coach K. So we're going to do them one by one. I want to start off first with Roy Williams. You're a big North Carolina fan. For those that don't know, KJ has been following North Carolina longer than he's been alive. I don't know how that's possible, but he has.
Tar Heels and Bruins, baby.
Yeah, I know. So how do you feel about Roy Williams retiring? He's brought some national championships there, countless players making the NBA. What do you make of Roy stepping down?
No, it's tough. I think that Roy, if you just look at the record, obviously it's impressive. And I think about when Roy was at Kansas, the rap on him was that he couldn't win the big game. You know, Kansas had some really disappointing tournament performances, and you know, they had some other stretches where they got to the Final Four but couldn't really cash it in. It wasn't hard to see that he was a great coach, great recruiter, had a really fun style of play, and he turned down the Carolina job the first time because he wanted to win one at Kansas. And the time under Matt Doherty at Carolina, it was a shit show, you know, for lack of a better word. And Roy came in and not only fixed that right away by winning a national championship shortly after he got there, but it created the type of stability that Dean Smith created. But he did more championship winning than Dean Smith did. And it was a lot more of an exciting brand of basketball than what Dean Smith was a proponent of. So I think that, you know, you got all those traditional Carolina vibes that people love, but it was high-level, entertaining stuff. Roy was always a class act, you know, and you know, people that have dealt with them in the recruiting world, that have dealt with them just in the college coaching world, everybody just said, you know, Roy was really what you saw. Like, he was a really nice, personable guy who was an elite coach. So I think that for Carolina, the family means a lot for them. Like, I don't think there's another college program, football or basketball, aside from Miami football, where like the family stuff is just really as hardcore as it is at Carolina. But Roy is a credit to the sport, credit to the university, and he fixed something that was in dire need of being repaired. And I think for that alone, if you look at his run at Carolina, it's hard to argue that he wasn't the best coach in college basketball in the last 20 years.
Now, I have to let people know the fact that, yeah, I like North Carolina, but I really liked Roy Williams at Kansas. I thought he did an amazing job with the Jayhawks. They were always in national championship contention. I got the 2003 national championship game wrong. I really thought that Kansas was going to win with Nick Collison and Kurt Heinrich, and they did not. That was the emergence of Carmelo Anthony, and but Roy did an amazing, amazing job at Kansas, and really, if you look at what Larry Brown did in the 80s, and then when Roy took over the team, he really just carried them through the decade. You switch over to when he went to Carolina, and it really was to restore Carolina, because in those 2 years, Matt Doherty just sunk the whole damn ship, and Roy was able to do that. You know, had different incarnations of the team. You had the Raymond Felton era. You had the Ty Lawson era. You had Sean May. Funny story about Rashad McCants. I actually played him online on Xbox on the game one time. true story. Actually, cool guy. Really cool guy. I'll tell you more about the story off air. But yeah, it was Xbox Live, Left 4 Dead. Interesting guy. I'll just leave it at that. But, no, Roy's had...
Was this when he was still in the league? Or
no, he was with the Timberwolves. I thought it was a joke. I thought somebody just used his name to try to troll, and it was actually him, and he was on cam. So, no, it was actually him. It was very strange. But Roy had an amazing career with Kansas, with Carolina. You know, didn't win a national championship like he wanted to with Kansas, but to this day, they still love Roy Williams there. Carolina loves Roy Williams, brought some national championships. As I say, countless guys that made it to the NBA. You know, he has a great legacy. Some people say it tapered off towards the end. We know about the NCAA stuff, but that doesn't affect Roy Williams' legacy. Again, great coach, a guy that did it the right way for so many years. People have nothing but great things to say. Seems to be a hell of a dancer that we learned the last couple years. There's countless.
This is
gifts.
True. Like, yes. No coach in college has had more swag, drip, whatever you want to say, whether it be the J's, the dancing, the hats. Roy set himself apart in that, set him above the competition in that area also.
Yeah, I mean, the gifts are going to live on, the dancing, the Midnight Madness stuff, like, Roy really over the last couple of years, I don't know if he just said, fuck it, I'm going to do what I feel, but he has definitely shown us a different side over the past couple of years. Now, to let everybody know before I ask you about Coach K, sometimes joking with KJ, I go into a Dick Vitale voice. So I just want to let you guys know that's coming so you don't think that I'm tweaking on this side of the room.
Boy.
So I'm just going to let you know. I'm going to hit you with a Dick Vitale voice. And KJ, we have to ask you about Coach K, baby. Coach K, the greatest coach in the history of basketball. Better than Adolph Ruff, better than Roy Williams, better than John Wooden, better than Pat Riley, better than Phil Jackson, the greatest man ever. If I wasn't married, I would have married Coach K, but I couldn't do it. So KJ, now that Coach K is retiring, I have to retire. Tell us about Coach K.
I really wish he would have retired a long time ago. I'm talking about Dick Vitale right now, but...
Don't hurt my feelings, baby.
Truth hurts. Obviously with me being a Carolina fan, I don't like Duke.
Nah, you hate Duke.
And look, man, we made Coach K the avatar for our Twitter account.
I'm proud of you, man. You're showing some growth.
I don't know if you understand how hard it was for me to do that.
I thought you made a mistake. Thought it was somebody else.
I'm just saying, man, it was really hard for me to do that. But, you know, I didn't want to be petty. Biggest story in sports this week. But, no, I think if you look at it, outside of John Wooden, nobody has been more important to college basketball. And I'm not saying that meaning that I think that Coach K is, as far as pure coaching, I'm not saying I think that he is as good as John Wooden, or even a top five all-time, like, pure X's and O coach. We've had this discussion a lot offline, especially this season, considering, you know, how hard Duke fell off. You know, I told you, like, there are other coaches, as far as X's and O's are concerned, that I feel are better than Coach K. And I think you and I, being guys that don't just watch college basketball during the tournament, we watch all throughout the year, I think we have a little bit of room to stand on with that, but that's a different thing. But I think just the branding of what he has brought to the game as a whole. Now, he had a video game with Sega back in the 90s.
Game's trash,
you know, I never played
it. It was trash.
Yeah, I wanted it for the longest time, but we could just never find it. But, you know, he had a video game, Amex commercials, Team USA, like that whole thing, him coaching Team USA, and really just transforming Duke into something that was a good program. I mean, like, they were a good program that had produced some NBA players, but he made them iconic. And he did it at one of the best academic institutions in the country. A lot of great players that have come through there. College, you know, guys that were just great college players and then guys that have gone on to be great pros as well. Duke guys also tend to comport themselves in a good way. And I think that that's part of just the discipline that he's instilled in those guys and the type of kids that he recruits. So from that standpoint, he's a real credit to the game because he's been all about college basketball. You know, he's turned down some opportunities to coach in the NBA. I know he said that there was a time in the early 90s where he had a chance to coach. I think it was either the Celtics or the Pistons, and he turned it down. And then the Lakers became a real opportunity for him once they had traded Shaq and Kobe was looking to get his own guy. And, you know, he turned it down then. But he, even when he did Team USA, he was still pushing the overall wellness of college basketball. You know, you talked about that. He talked about how this was going to help all the under 17 teams and all the rest of it. So I think as an ambassador of the sport, as a coach, as a guy who did things as far as how he coached his players and how he wanted them to play the game, he did those things the way that you're supposed to. He adapted on court stylistically. I mean, who would have ever thought, if you would have watched Duke back when we were kids in the 90s, if you would have ever thought that Duke would become a driving kick team that shot all those threes that they do now? Would have never thought that I would see that. Adjusted his recruiting approach also several times. People could say what they want about college basketball recruiting and what goes into that, but he showed more flexibility in how he approached recruiting and how he approached building relationships with kids than his own mentor Bobby Knight did. And that's a guy that, and I love the fact that when he retired, he wanted to make it very clear he wasn't doing this because of the changes with name, image, and likeness or things like that. He was doing this just because he wanted to spend more time with his family. Now, who knows if that's true, but the bottom line is that's his way of basically telling all the old coaches that are complaining about what's going on in the sport now, get over it. Adjust or retire, but get over it. And I think that that's really, that pretty much symbolizes what he is as an ambassador for the sport. And I think the sport's going to miss him.
College basketball is definitely going to miss him, baby. I miss him already. I'm lonely. I miss Coach K.
Oh, man. It never gets old. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, he has done that jackass routine when he calls me on my birthday. So this is not, he's not just breaking this out for the first time. Like, this is
nah, I'm he's actually been working more obnoxious on his birthday about this than anything. What I will say with Coach K, he's been an institution with college basketball. And if you think about what he's meant to the sport, he's meant so much over this tenure. And Duke, rather you loved him or rather you hated him, Duke has been a staple of college basketball, and so has he. And you look at the guys that have gone through Duke, very, very key thing. And if you look at what Coach K has done with his teams, his championship teams, they're all different. If you look at the Christian Laettner group, going later to the Jason Williams and Mike Dunleavy group, going later to the Jahlil Okafor group, they won it in different ways. And that is a coach that looks at the talent that he has on his roster and adapts to the talent. He has a system and he has certain things that he wants to do, but if he has certain players on his team, he works with their strengths and not their weaknesses, and not trying to pigeonhole a system to make them conform to a system. Whatever they're good at, that's what he focuses on. Coach K has just been a staple with ACC basketball, college basketball, a lot of tournament losses, but also a lot of tournament successes. So it's a sad day because even with John Shire taking over, and we'll talk about him and Hubert Davis in a second, it's not going to be the same hating Duke or loving Duke.
No, yes, it's not. I mean, I think if you're a Duke fan, because Shire is a young guy and he played for them within the last decade, there is going to be a certain effect of, you know, he was won a national championship there. There's going to be a lot of support around him, and I think that there is more juice around his hire than even Hubert Davis's hire. But no, you can't have a guy like Coach K or Roy Williams retire and expect that it's going to still have the same intensity off the bat. Now, look, we get to our first Carolina Duke game. You know, Coach K is going to coach one more year. But if we get to our first Carolina Duke game in 2 years, you know, it gets cracking. And, you know, by that point, Lord willing, you know, we're back to complete full capacity in stands, and it's a testy matchup, and we see some things happen on the recruiting trail, then we know that things have picked back up just with different faces. But at least in the short term, it's going to be look a lot different and not feel the same.
Well, let me ask you about Hubert Davis, John Shire. You know, they have obvious hurdles that they have to overcome, but what do you think their biggest hurdles are for them to be successful? Because both programs have kind of lost some momentum. What do each guy need to do in order to regain that?
Well, I think the main thing for Hubert is Carolina has recruited at a high level the last couple of years. You know, I've actually been annoyed by the take in the college basketball media that they just haven't been recruiting like they once did. I mean, they won a national championship within the last 5 years. They've done it by taking kids that are high four-star, lower-end five-star guys that are 2 or 3 year players. And the reason why you do that, you're getting high-level future NBA-type talents, but you're getting guys that are going to be in the program you develop. Problem is that last batch, the batch that had Cole Anthony, Armando Bacot, all those guys, aside from Cole Anthony, those other guys never really panned out and played up to their expectation. And that means something. And I think that when you have a big recruiting class and guys don't develop the way that you would expect them to, it can set you back. And there was several McDonald's All-Americans on that team. So once again, it does not mean that there's been a talent drain as far as how we normally judge talent drains. So I think for Hubert, Carolina is going to be able to recruit itself to a certain degree. But I do think that on staff, there's going to have to be a bit of a shakeup. I wasn't really a big fan of him being so insular, even with the staff hires. I mean, everybody on the staff has a North Carolina connection. I think that's overdoing it a bit. If the best people that you hire just happen to have Carolina connections, fine. But he made it a point to where if you were going to get hired on that staff, you had to be a UNC alum. And I think that that's not the way to approach it. But I think for them, maybe being a little bit more aggressive in their approach to recruiting bigs, that would help. And from a stylistic standpoint, focusing more on precision instead of pace would be a good thing. But he's taken over a program that's prepared to win. And as far as John Shire goes, he's been in on a lot of Duke's recruiting of their most recent recruiting classes. Coach K has given them a lot of responsibility as far as practice is concerned and drills and things like that. So he's already been groomed as the next guy up. The thing for him is going to be making sure that he has a level of autonomy once Coach K retires, because reportedly Coach K is going to still have an office there and he's still going to be around the team and around the program as an ambassador. Being around but still letting Shire do his job is fine, but Shire's going to have to find the line between not pissing off his mentor and respecting his mentor but still establishing, like, you know, this is my job now. Duke is going to recruit. You know, they're tied in. That's not going to be an issue. I'm assuming he's going to keep a lot of the same staff. Obviously, you know, he'd have to hire another assistant that's going to take his old spot. But I think for him, it's just going to be really about establishing that he is the guy while still respecting Coach K's legacy. You know, you don't want to go like Matt Daugherty, who got the North Carolina job and tried to basically act as if he invented North Carolina basketball, despite the fact that Dean Smith is one of the five greatest coaches of all time. So you don't want to do that. But at the same time, you don't also want to just be viewed as Coach K's lapdog that got the job because of, you know, close proximity. You know, so he's going to have to straddle that line. And I think that if he can find the right balance there, Duke is going to stay elite.
I don't think both programs have fallen off on hard times. I just think they're not doing what everyone expects them to do, because, as you said, the standard, the bar was so high for so many years. You know, if Carolina doesn't win 24 games, it's a bad season. If Duke doesn't win 24, 25 games, it's a bad season. They don't have a guy that's drafted in the top four. Oh, they're not recruiting at the same level. And I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, we've seen what Cole Anthony healthy can do. Hell, we've seen what he did this year with the Magic. Mm-hmm. But the issue has been, as you said, some of those guys haven't panned out as far as the All-Americans that Carolina recruited. And when you recruit a McDonald's All-American and they're not panning out, you know, that can set things back because you're expecting guys to be there 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and they're not panning out, and then you're having to recruit over them. You know, that can lead to some issues. With Duke, I don't think they're that far away either. I just think they're a recruiting class away from being good again. We're talking about the ACC, so I don't think both programs are going to take a dip. I just think it's difficult replacing a legend. It doesn't matter what the sport is. It's difficult replacing a legend and being that next coach to replace them because everybody expects you to be that guy, and you have your own philosophies, your own beliefs, your own way of doing things. So you don't want to disrespect what has been already established. At the same time, you're trying to establish yourself. Now, both of those guys, Hubert Davis being a Carolina guy, Shire being a Duke guy, they know the history, they know the prestige. I think as long as they don't do anything too crazy, honestly, I think both of them would be fine. The question is, are we going to get that rivalry, or are they just going to be polite about it? Because we kind of live in a PC culture, and everybody's kind of afraid to offend anybody. So are we really going to get a Carolina-Duke rivalry?
Nah, the rivalry never dies. You know, like, it's going to be there. It's just, they're going to need to be able to establish their own cultures as they step out of the shadows of the people that they were, the men that they replaced. But the rivalry, every day you're reminded about how much you hate the other program. Just because of the fact of recruiting, being in the same state, everything that that Carolina-Duke rivalry entails. So, no, it's going to ramp up. Like, I have no doubt that it's going to ramp up. And within the next 2 or 3 years, at least as far as they're concerned, elbows are going to be back out, and it's going to all be about the hatred. Now, how they are in the grand scheme of college basketball, have they been able to keep up with the other elite programs? That's where the question is going to be. But, you know, that rivalry will never lose its steam.
You sound like you're ready to go.
Always.
So it's still hate Duke season always?
Look, man. I know we're live on air, but if you look at your phone and what I just sent you, like, it's that type of energy.
Oh, man. I am so grateful this is not a YouTube stream right now because this is not podcast friendly. My God. The hell did I just look at? All I can tell you guys is this man really does not like Duke at all. Because anybody that was sent this to somebody really doesn't like a college basketball program.
You know the vibes. That's what I'm saying, man.
Oh,
it's, you
man.
Know.
That's wild. That's wild. That's a hell of a way to close out a podcast. Wow.
It was fun doing this again.
Oh, man. Before we wrap up, is there anything that you would like to add or touch on?
Nah, man. We just got to be consistent for the people. You know, we had a lot to get out today because we just haven't recorded in a while. But, you know, I look forward to recording this from my home studio on a weekly basis and getting the content out there. Shout out to Blue Wire. Shout out to Family Media Network, Family Clothes, Family Foundation. Shout out to you, my brother. Love you. Glad to be back at it. And, you know, that's it.
Sports-wise, before I do my shout-outs, I do have to give a shout-out to the U.S. men's national team. They played Mexico yesterday, and they won the inaugural CONCACAF Nations League Cup.
Timeline was heated.
Crazy game. Really chaotic, actually. You know, they responded. This is a very young group of U.S. national players. A lot of good individual players, but this is really their first trophy that they won together as a national team. You know, some people said this didn't matter because it was a friendly, but as you saw with the game, the timeline, this mattered. I know they're going to play again in the Gold Cup in July, but big win for the U.S. men's national team. As far as the shout-outs, got to give you a shout-out. You've been my brother for a long time. Glad to be back on the podcast with you. Shout-out to Blue Wire. Appreciate everything that they've done. Shout-out to family. Shout-out to family. 100%. You guys are amazing. Shout-out to the new listeners. Shout-out to the old listeners. I also want to give out my Twitter handle. Twitter handle is @MateoGrindwork. KJ's is @KJGrindwork. A lot of jokes.
KJ underscore grind
work. See, I've gotten it wrong. I'm still laughing about the Duke joke. Appreciate you guys. We got a lot of content coming out, and this is one of many. And, sir, if there's nothing else, I will speak to you this time next week.